Hey, everybody, Patrick Connor here, and welcome to the Knuckles and Gloves podcast. It's a return to history today, dude. We did this recap of the weekend the other day. It was great, fun weekend, but we got to return to history, which means I'm here with my dude, Aris Pina, CompuBox operator, just a fellow history lover like myself. Aris, what's up, bro? How are you?
Everything's good, my friend. You know, unfortunately, winding down a vacation that I took from my 9-to-5 job, but otherwise, things are all right, man. We got a slow week ahead of us in terms of like current boxing action. So you and I were talking about it. I thought it was a good time to revisit one of our favorite subjects, mythical matchups. Ooh. So here we are.
Yeah, man. The other day I put out the distress signal. I put out the SOS for the show. I said, people, if you got ideas for mythical matchups, send them our way. I was like overwhelmed. I'd put out a couple feelers like a while back, months ago, like, hey, anybody have suggestions? I got like two responses and shit like that. And I was like, damn, dude, it's kind of sad. Whoa, we got totally flooded. So we're not going to get through them all. We're just going to go through some random ones today. If we don't name yours, we'll probably just have more shows. We'll probably just do.
I mean,
more.
We did three parts on Biggest Puncher. So I'm sure we're going to have more than just two on mythical matchups because this is a favorite subject of everyone.
And it's October too. So that means that we got the International Boxing Hall of Fame vote coming up. You and I, we got our ballots to discuss at some point.
Cause I was going to totally forget. And it's going to be the 31st. And I'm going to get taken off the ballot.
Yeah, man. We got our ballots to discuss. I got to fill out mine. So it's coming up. But in the meanwhile, mythical. So we're genuine, but we swear we're not just saying we got the ballots right there. We got a lot of shit to talk about, though, because we got a lot of mythical matchups. So I'm just going to start firing them. Dude, I wrote them all down, tried to organize them. Like I said, if we don't get to yours, we will soon, I promise. But let's start with the first one. From Instagram, we got JJ_FosterGotti. And his idea, we got a fun one. I thought this one was pretty fun. Arturo Gotti versus Miguel Cotto. And that fight could have happened at one point. I mean, it ain't that far off. They were just kind of going in different directions, I think, at 140 pounds. But, and also, I don't know if Gotti wanted to make 140 pounds for very long at that point. However, that's a fun fight. I mean, Gotti's in fun fights. Cotto was in a lot of fun fights. What do you think that happens in that one, dude?
I mean, you got to favor Cotto in that fight, regardless. I mean, Gotti, as good as he always was, and he was a hell of a fun fighter. That's the reason why he got inducted into the Hall of Fame and a legend for that. One of the all-time great action fighters. You know what I mean? I'm not putting him on the same level as like Asad Muhammad or something, but Gotti holds his place in history. And for you and I, when we came up as fans in the 90s, Gotti was always, you know, just must-see television regardless. You know what I mean? Whether he was fighting Tracy Patterson when he first made his HBO debut to the unknown Wilson Rodriguez and that dramatic war that kind of solidified what the early days of HBO Boxing After Dark ended up being. To, you know, you move on to like even the fights that no one expected were going to end up being wars, the Ivan Robinson fights, his fight with Calvin Grove, which no one talks about in terms of Gotti wars, but that one's criminally underrated.
That's up there, dude, and that never gets talked about. Yeah, it's always Ruelas and Rodriguez.
And obviously because those were fights that were on either pay-per-view or HBO. The Calvin Grove fight was on what, like ABC or something back then. That was after Gotti was already a non-champion. I think he'd given up his belt. Yeah, but Grove, who was already way past that former champion, gave Gotti the business that fight. He put up a hell of a fight. Regardless, Gotti just, he always commanded the wars. And Cotto, the thing about Cotto, of course, you know, we watched him come up the way he was developed by Top Rank, and he was featured on pay-per-views and HBO, and matched very, very well from the very beginning. We saw him against guys like Lovemore Endu and Victoriano Sosa and others, the way he was being slowly built, but like, you know, he had that pedigree, and you already saw it early on the way he was like crouched and everything, and little by little he was just getting more and more fundamentally solid. And by the time he beat Kelson Pinto for his first belt, you know, he was almost like a finished product. By the time I think he moved up and beat Quintana for the vacant welterweight belt, that's when I think prime Cotto came in.
I didn't expect him to do that to Quintana. I thought Quintana would give him a lot of trouble, honestly.
Absolutely. And this was before Quintana beat Paul Williams, right?
It was around then. I don't remember precise. I'd have to look. I just remember that I thought style-wise, Cotto's moving up and Quintana's, you know, kind of a tricky guy. He might give him some problems, and no, he didn't at all.
Yeah. But if you just, I mean, like, it would be one of those type of fights, Cotto and Gotti, that their styles would mesh well, very, very well. Cotto wasn't a runner. Like, he could box well, but he was a guy that was a pressure fighter moving forward. Gotti wasn't going to run away from you at all, obviously. And Gotti had underrated boxing skills. So I think they would probably try to go, you know, match both and both. But at some point, they're going to go trade the heat. And there's a good chance Gotti could clip him and wobble Cotto, because Cotto could get hit. He could get hurt. And we saw that dramatically against, like, Ricardo Torres and others. But at the end of the day, I think Cotto's overall skill would, you know, overtake Gotti and stop him late.
I have to agree, dude. I mean, I know that Gotti's a sentimental favorite for a lot of people. You know, I post shit about Gotti and people are like, the GOAT, the greatest. And I'm like, I understand what you're saying, but no, he wasn't even remotely close to it. And obviously, though, in terms of action fighters, he's easily one of the greatest action fighters of the last 25 to 30 years.
Totally.
You know, I'm not going to be arguing any of that, of course. But yeah, the tendency to get sucked into a brawl, generally speaking, he had a lack of plan to fall back on if something didn't work. And the
swelling, man, before even the fight would start.
Yeah, the cuts, the scar tissue, the swelling. I mean, he got touched up and it would be kind of just like Niagara Falls. So, I mean, there are a number of things going against him in that.
You remember in the Rodriguez fight where that doctor got way too overdramatic? It's the only time I've seen a doctor stop being an asshole in the corner. And he was like, cover your eyes. First he yells at Joe. What was the cornerman's name? Joe, wasn't Joe Goosen, obviously. It was a, you know what I'm talking about? The guy with the glasses that was famous. Yeah. Shit, he was from New Bedford too, so I should know his name. Like, he was a Massachusetts resident. But you know what I'm talking, he always had the in his mouth and everything.
Yeah.
God, his last name escapes me really quick.
Yeah, he always had the Q-tip. Yeah. Yeah.
And first off,
yeah, I should have known.
The doctor yells at him, and Joe Souza said, "Don't push me, goddammit." Like, he straight up yells at him. Like,
let me work on the fucking cut, bro. Yeah, because exactly. You're like, I need my minute to work on the cut.
And, like, doctor is like almost, you can feel like he's just on television. So he's going to be like trying to, you know, get his moment. Because then he starts on Gotti. He goes, cover your eye. And then Gotti pulls there. He's like, cover your eye. I'm stopping the fight. I've never heard a doctor start acting like a dickhead like that, you know?
Yeah, he's trying to be the star dude or something.
Exactly. And Gotti, you know, answer the questions and all that. Then he went out the next round and knocked him out. But yeah, that's just.
Yeah, dude, he's obviously had some wars, obviously had some great moments, but it was just, yeah, I think he's overmatched. And on top of that, Cotto carried his weight better as he moved up. And part of that was timing, blah, blah, blah. But I think Cotto just would have been, he might have even been the heavier puncher and absorbing stuff better. And on, especially at 147 pounds, because Gotti just didn't. By that time,
gonna match them early on, like the Cotto that fought Ricardo Torres against Gotti around that time could have been very explosive.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, that could have been disastrous for Cotto. It had been the wrong night, but at, you know, best versus best,
Cotto.
I'm not entirely sure you can give that to Gotti. Mm-hmm. Let's see. There was another. Actually, there was a lot of really good matchups that people had. Let's go to Teep to the Junk on Twitter. We know him pretty well. He's always supporting the show. Thank you, by the way. But he had a good one. A number of people had a bunch of them, by the way. So I had to kind of pick and choose. Sam Lankford versus Archie Moore.
Shit.
Yeah, I saw that and was like, all right, I'm writing that shit down. You know, dude, it's Archie Moore, obviously, up until a handful of years ago when the research was a little bit more complete and people thought, Billy Bird actually might have the knockout record now after everything's compiled. I don't know. It doesn't really matter that much, to be honest. The point being, you know, Archie Moore, Billy Bird, who all those guys, young stripling, they could fucking hit. They knocked out a lot of fools. They knocked out a lot of human beings. But then you have a guy in Sam Lankford who's carrying his weight from lightweight. They're carrying that punching power from lightweight all the way up to heavyweight, fighting and beating the shit out of fighters way larger than him, I think it's probably more an issue of him just totally maximizing his skill and technique, versus Archie Moore probably just having heavy hands at that weight or whatever. But even so, two supremely skilled fighters, both had incredible longevity. Obviously, Langford was never given the chances that Archie Moore was given, where Archie Moore kind of started out in that, you know, Black Murderers Row group and almost like fought his way out of it in a way and got opportunities that a number of other fighters. By the time
he got his title shot, most people's careers would have been done.
Right. And he was, he somehow managed to guide himself to opportunities that, well, not just himself, obviously, but point being a lot of those other fighters in the Black Murderers Row just simply never got to or were never given. So, I mean, that's a really intriguing matchup, dude.
I agree, man. I've never even thought about a fight like that, but that is really fascinating. And fuck, you know, the amount, like the minds going against each other, because both of them were brilliant minds in the ring. Moore was, if you've read about, you know, his techniques and what he thought about and how he proceeded with everything he did for each round, like, you know, it's one of the great minds in boxing history. Langford the same way. And both guys, they'd be playing chess against each other, you know, trying to feign each other out of position, the moves, everything about it. Plus, both of them having one punch knockout power too would have that ability that they both be aware that they can get cold, caught really quickly and taken out. Honestly, I'm gonna say right here, it's probably flip a coin. Like, I want to slightly lean toward Langford, but like, Moore could easily on one day just take him out as well. Like, it's one of those fights that if you match them up 5 days out of the week, I think Langford takes three out of them.
You know, they each were stopped more than once.
Totally. So, and I mean, with the longevity of their careers, it's inevitable that would happen. And Langford coming up from lightweight, moving up to heavyweight and fighting guys so much bigger than him and fighting as long as he did with his eyesight failing and everything as such like that, he was going to have to take L's and sometimes get knocked out, like against guys that were inferior to him. Like a guy like Fred Fulton, who's most famous for being blasted by Dempsey in, what, 15 seconds or whatever.
Yeah, something like
knocked
that.
Knocked out Langford.
Yeah, he got but, John Ruiz'd.
Yeah, exactly. And he knocked out Langford. And but when you think about it, Langford was probably the superior, obviously the superior fighter. But a guy like, you know, that was huge compared to someone like Langford, you know what I mean, who was extremely small at that time and could be compared to someone like Barbados Joe Walcott, who kind of came up the same way, even smaller than Langford. But same thing, moved on, you know, fought from the lower divisions and was knocking out guys like Kowinski at one point. So,
yeah, I honestly agree, dude. It's pretty much a flip a coin type of thing. It could be whoever lands first.
Fascinating fight. That is a fascinating mythical matchup. And one that would have been amazing to watch too. Like the type of thing where we talk about watching Mike McCallum and James Toney, and you say, yeah, it's always like the litmus for people that should, like, you know, getting into the sport, they should watch a tape of that to see the skill and the technique involved in what they're doing, countering each other, yada, yada, yada. Back then, that would be the same thing. That would be a fight like that, totally.
Yeah, dude, you even look at, like, their, if you're trying to find some sort of weakness between them or something like that, you look at, like, their stoppage losses, and yes, some of Moore's stoppage losses were to really, really good fighters toward middleweight or, like, just, you know, before he'd kind of developed into a full-size light heavyweight, and they were really good fighters. Nothing to be ashamed of. And then similarly, you know, Sam Langford, most of the fighters he was getting stopped by were either late in his career or much larger than him. So it's kind of like you can't really find much between them there, you know. You put them together at like light heavyweight or something like that, and you have a hell of a fight. Yeah, I don't know how you really pick that. I guess I would probably go with Langford just on durability overall, but I'm not going to be mad at anybody picking more.
Honestly, I might try to recreate that on Fight Night today. Now that was made, that's like pretty awesome.
Yeah, dude, I'll find one of these, you know, one of those old games where you like plug in all the, they have like computer games and shit like that where you try.
Because I got, yeah, that's a fascinating fight. Good one. That's a really good one.
Yeah,
but I slightly lean toward Langford if you match them up over and over.
Yeah, I thought that one was pretty cool. Let's see. There was another one that I thought was pretty interesting. Frederic Avali on Facebook. I told you we got like a good spread. I was actually surprised, but he came up with Azuma Nelson versus Alexis Arroyo.
Damn, it's another really good fight,
dude. There were a lot of really good ones. I was impressed. Well,
what weight though?
I would imagine 130.
That'd be like 130, right?
Yeah, I would imagine 130 because that's Azuma's best weight. And it was still a pretty good weight for, you know, Alexis Arguello. So, I mean, that's probably a really fun fight. Arguello would sometimes drop decisions around that time to not even bad fighters, but it would just be kind of like decisions he probably wasn't expected to drop.
Like Vilomar Fernandez, which we mentioned on a previous show.
Right. Good fighter, but not, you know, not the kind of fight necessarily that you would expect him to lose. But he could be defeated. It was just that.
I mean, Arguello personified like the everything that's, I mean, right about boxing and his stance and everything like that. Like he did everything perfectly well. Like he had the perfect stance. He threw everything perfect, like, well, like, you know, his uppercuts, his combinations, he was tall, he was lanky. He was just, you know, the a precise fighter. And then you master in like how much of a classy individual he was. And he just molded into like almost like a god among men. But like you said, there were, you know, some things in his style that could be exploited. Like he wasn't the quickest on his feet. He had to really settle it on his feet to really let his combinations go. And he could be touched up sometimes. And I mean, Alfredo Escalera, who we won the title from and subsequently beat him in a rematch, Arguello beat him from pillar to post. Don't get me wrong. Like Arguello was more or less in control of both fights, but after both of those fights, Arguello was heavily marked up as well, you know, and he was dropped and marked up in other fights too. Yeah, both at lightweight and junior lightweight. So, like, could be touched. Azuma Nelson, you know, what else can be said about him? From when he first came up fighting Salvador Sanchez and running him to the very limit to knocking out Wilfredo Gomez and then moving up to junior lightweight and starting that historic run. Like, Nelson, one of the past 40 years, is one of the best fighters we've seen, easily in the top 10. And everything about him too, they didn't call him the professor for nothing, you know what I mean? As his career went on, and he was such an aggressive dynamo early on, just kind of overpowering guys with his, you know, and bullying and beating the shit out of him, to where he like slowed down and you would just see the nuances to his game and how he's exploited things and would just be able to pull decisions out. Like Nelson was just a class in itself too. It would be a really good fight, another one that would go down to the limit, but I think Arguello with his height and length and everything else would be able to hold him off for a very close decision. But he would definitely have a lot of rough moments. Like, it wouldn't be easy at all.
Yeah, one of the, and not to talk it down, not to talk down Azuma Nelson's performance against Sanchez at all, but I feel like a decent portion of that was like the element of surprise.
Of course, absolutely.
You know, they didn't really know precisely what they were getting into, and fair play, like, whatever, you know, it's that's boxing. But I'm not going to say it doesn't count. You know, they didn't really know much about Azuma Nelson going in. You know, Mickey Duff and all these dudes behind bringing him in and kind of getting him that into that position, you know, massive. But the element of surprise, and assuming that's not there, you know, here and just, but nonetheless at their best, that's a tough fight, dude, because Azuma Nelson's a tough fight for anybody on his best night around that weight from 126 pounds, probably to lightweight. But at 130 pounds, especially, if not the greatest fighter at that weight, clearly like top two or three or something like that at that weight. And that's a pretty good weight class, even in
and itself. The longevity that he held too, because, you know, he was a standout throughout from the early 80s up until then. And then even in the mid 90s, when you thought he was going to go away after losing to Jesse James Leja, and then he comes back, knocks the shit out of Gabriel Relos, who, you know, you got to put an asterisk on that. Relos obviously was coming off the after effects of beating Jimmy Garcia, who subsequently passed away, unfortunately. But still, no one thought Nelson was going to win that fight. And he had been away for a long time. He came back, knocked out Relos, thrashed him, really. And then he goes on HBO Boxing After Dark, fights Leja, who had already looked like he had his number, and then beat the shit out of him on that fight, too. Like, first round, hit him with that fastball overhand, right, that he's famous for. Pow! And Leja just went down the canvas and looked like he got hit with a, you know, by a Porsche, just laying there. And Nelson more or less toyed with him after that. Like, that was, I loved watching Nelson as a kid, because even though he's in the tail end of his career, I just knew I was watching somebody special. And he carried himself in such a regal manner. And, you know, the handlers around him, and I loved hearing those drums outside the ring, which I've told you before, must have been intimidating as shit for any opponent for him. Because you got to fight that guy, and then you just hear out there, which, you know, and certainly not for you. So,
earlier on, especially in his career, on the fights that he that he had on TV too. I can't remember specifically which announcers, but every so often they would, instead of just calling him the professor, they'd say the professor of boxing, Azuma Nelson. It was just, it was great. Like, it's one of the all time great fucking nicknames in my opinion, but it fit. And I remember, like, obviously I was not a fan at that time to remember him all the way back. But I do remember his comeback, and I remember, you know, his name and him having just a really memorable nickname too. But a really great fighter, a fun fighter to watch, a guy who would have given Alexis Arguello hell. So however that fight ended up, I mean, I would probably lean toward Arguello. I think he's the better fighter overall, like the greater fighter, probably would have found a way to win and had the length, had the jab to get it done.
And he had the inside game too, if necessary.
He did. Yeah, he did kind of have a little bit of that Corrales going on, where, like, you know, he looked like he wouldn't have an inside game. Bitches,
man. You know, and those body shots he can throw, so, like, totally.
Yeah, he doubled over Hawaiian Punch.
Andy Gannigan.
Yeah, Andy Gannigan with body shots just destroyed him. And Andy Gannigan was a tough guy, too. So, yeah, I'd probably go with Arguello. But like you said, there were moments where he could kind of get robotic and get hit. So it would be a really fun fight.
I wouldn't be surprised. Arguello would probably hit the deck in that fight, if, you know, briefly before you have to come back and rally. I'm not sure if he even stops Nelson. Probably doesn't stop him. Nelson doesn't, you know, besides the Sanchez fight where he was still young in his career and the way he put the pace on that one. If we're talking season Nelson, this is definitely going 12 to 15.
Yeah, I mean, there's a possibility Arguello could break him down, I guess. But if he didn't one-shot him, he usually wasn't that type of fighter where he'd, like, really go after somebody like that, unless he knew it was there.
Exactly.
But no, that's like I said, some really fun matchups. That was another one. So let's see. Let's go back. There were a shitload on Twitter. So let's go back to Twitter. Our boy Stogio, I thought he had a couple of pretty good ones, and I thought this was a little interesting proposition. Stogio on Twitter asked Roy Jones Jr. versus Chris Bird and James Toney versus Mike Tyson, winners face each other.
Okay.
So Jones Jr. versus Bird.
So Toney, it's Tyson. Heavyweight, obviously.
Yeah, at heavyweight. I mean, Roy Jones versus Chris Bird is kind of, that's one of those, like, you know, so much twitching, so much posturing and fainting and stuff like that. It would have been really interesting to the quote unquote purist, but, like, it would have been like, God damn it. So frustrating for so much of the,
you know, fight, it's, you know? Interesting because all these fights potentially could have happened back in the early 2000s. You know, when Roy Jones,
think he said 2003.
That makes around, like that. That's about the, that makes sense because that's when Tony moved up to heavyweight to knock out Evander Holyfield, right? After he beat Vasily Jirov. And Jones back in March of 03, because that was 03, right?
Mm-hmm.
March of 03, he moved up to beat John Ruiz, and no one was sure at that point if he was going to go back down to light heavyweight because that was such a splash, and he beat Ruiz so convincingly. Not that Ruiz was a world beater, but, you know, it was still impressive in itself that the money was there and the intrigue was like, oh, is he going to fight Holyfield? Is he going to fight Tyson? Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, everybody.
Yeah, I remember he said that he wanted to fight Lennox Lewis, but he'd only do it for $100 million.
Yeah. And there was even talk about him fighting Corey Sanders, which would have been disastrous in my opinion. But Sanders, I think, would have blasted his head off.
Oh, yeah, because he actually had quick hands and he wouldn't have fucked around with him. He would have been like, oh, you know, jab, jab. He would have been like, no, buddy, we're coming after you.
I think after what happened, there's no way, man. But in that time, if he had fought as a Chris Bird, that was another one, I guess, that was another name that was thrown out there. And like you said, Pat, that's not a fight that would have been exciting at all. But it would have been intriguing, man, because Bird would have been the one guy at that division that would have been able to keep up with Jones in terms of hand quickness and just movement and everything. Because Bird, you have to remember, wasn't a natural heavyweight. When he was Olympian back in the 92 Olympics, he was a middleweight before he he won the bronze or silver, after losing to Cuba's great Ariel Hernandez. And when he turned pro, he moved right up the heavyweight, just bulked up, you know, because he knew that's where the money was and various reasons. And it was always fascinating watching Bird at heavyweight, even if he wasn't the most exciting. If you watched him early on when he was doing his thing on Tuesday Night Fights and, you know, beating guys like Lionel Butler or, you know, Craig Payne, I want to say the guy's name was, and a few others. He looked good, but you were just kind of like, eh. But I mean, it was still fascinating to watch because you hadn't seen anything like this since maybe like Jimmy Young, you know. And then when he finally made his debut on HBO and beat the shit out of Jimmy Thunder, that's when eyes were open. I remember watching that with my dad. And Thunder, who was always a personal favorite, a lot of us loved him back in the day because, you know, for the knockouts he scored, and he was just all around fun fighter to watch, right? But Bird just, that was probably his most fun fight in terms of him dominating somebody, because Thunder couldn't do a thing with him, and Bird, you know, got more and more emboldened to start whooping on him. And by the time the fight was stopped, Bird was over there looking like Roy Jones, flowing those flurries on him, and Thunder just, you know, looking like a low rent clubber Lang trying to hold his hands up and getting his head knocked around in a swivel. So all that being said, but if you're talking about 2003, this Bird that I was talking about was the late 90s. By the time 2003 happened, Bird had already slowed down a bit. You know, I mean, he was getting touched up more. Some of his fights were like, he was eking out decisions against the likes of giants like Jamil McClain, or also guys more of his size, but just awkward and wanky like Frezzo Kendo. So if you're talking about that Bird, I think Jones can eke out a decision against him.
That's, yeah, he might, dude. He very well might. He might be able to just kind of outspeed him. He might be able to outbird Bird. You know what I mean?
I think he would have. By that time, Bird had slowed up by 0-3.
I could buy that. Yeah. And then you put, so if we both agree, let's say Chris Bird against the winner of James Toney and Mike Tyson. I mean, to me, that's Thunder actually...
Winner of James Toney, Mike Tyson?
That's actually, and I know that Mike Tyson was not that guy by this time, but if you put a James Toney who stands still on the ropes against any version of Mike Tyson, that could be a really bad idea. You know, like, I mean, is it likely to be a bad idea? Probably not, dude. I think James Toney probably takes it. But if he stands still long enough, could be bad.
Toney was uncanny, though, man. The guy could just take a hell of a punch. He doesn't get brought up enough, in my opinion, for in terms of all-time great chins. I mean, sure, he was rocked a couple of times. I think, you know, suffered a flash knockdown here and there. But Toney could take a tremendous shot. He did against tons of fighters. Always went the distance. Even like late in his career when he got the shit kicked out of him against Dennis Lebedev in that sad fight that should have never taken place. He never lost his feet, you know. So I think by 03, when he was, I think, peaking again, like in his second, you know, and basically like his second prime almost, where he just, you know, he was fighter of the year that year, right? 2003.
I think so, yeah.
And I mean, like, he was in shape, he was motivated, he was looking good. And if he was going to fight Tyson, I'm sure he would have been even more motivated than he was to fight Holyfield. And Toney, as slick as he was in Tyson at that point in 2003, he was still explosive, but with all the deficiencies he had going on and outside the ring issues he had going on, which at this point was at a height for him, Toney, if he had weathered the storm through four rounds, would have ended up stopping Tyson. Definitely.
Probably, yeah. I think he probably wind up stopping him.
At that point, we'd end up getting a rematch between Roy Jones and James Toney at heavyweight. That's how I would look at it, yeah.
Which is pretty interesting, to be honest. I mean, because it's not the greatest style for Toney, whatever weight it's at. Because Toney's the kind of fighter who wants a fighter to come to him.
Totally.
And he doesn't want to have to do the counter-punching bit. And, you know, Roy Jones would probably make him try to chase him just like in that first fight and then walk him into traps.
He would.
I don't know, man.
And so, I don't know, you know, it's at heavyweight where Toney is not going to be weight drained the way he was at super middleweight, and he's not going to be
fair
like
point two, yeah.
Struggling and all that. I think it would be a more competitive fight. I think it would have been a really good fight. Something that fans could have got into and everything, but at the end of the day, I think still Jones with his style just would have been able to outmaneuver him and still eke out a decision. Jones in 2003, before he moved back to light heavyweight and drained himself, and subsequently his career kind of faltered after that. At heavyweight, still we just don't know, man. He only had that one fight, and I wish he could have stood there because the division was kind of open at that time for him to do some damage. You know, we like I said, Tyson was past it, but he was still active. Holyfield was active, but he was past it. And besides Lennox Lewis, who he was never going to beat, or like the absolute giants of that division, there was guys he could have fought for massive amounts of money and definitely beat them. So
that could have been pretty interesting. Roy Jones winding up on top in that 2003 mythical tournament.
Exactly.
Would have been pretty crazy. How it could have been had he just ignored Antonio Tarver's constant taunting. But dude, you know, Tarver did it right. He was showing up at all the press conferences and public appearances.
You
have a light
on it, man. You know what I mean? You say enough shit to somebody and get on their neck enough, and if that person believes that you're like, if that that person believes that, you know, they're nothing compared to you, then eventually they're gonna come try to fight you. You know?
Oh man, yeah.
Looks like where that creep movie is going. So.
It's a mistake. Shouldn't have gone, or he should have had Tarver come up. That's probably what he should have done. So like, all right, fine, come back up, come up here then, come up and fight me up here. That's probably what he should have done, but he didn't. Big mistake. Let's see what else we got a lot of shit. Let's see. All right, this was a pretty good one. I thought that was a fun power puncher fight. It is I'm trying to Dent Apreriven on Instagram. Not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but Gennady Golovkin versus Julian Jackson.
It's a fight that's been discussed on Twitter. Absolutely.
For sure. Yeah. I thought it was, hey man, you know, puncher versus puncher. Who doesn't want puncher versus puncher? It's a pretty good one. But I told you earlier, I tried to kind of keep some of the mythical matchups that we were suggested out of it, because they were fighters whose careers weren't done yet or something. Gennady Golovkin's still fighting, but he's obviously
torn. But no, this is definitely a mythical matchup that's worthy of talking about because of, just like you said, two of them being the biggest punchers in the division's history. You know, it is a fight that like a lot of people have talked about before, not to diminish it right now, but like, because it's so exciting and enticing to think about, you know, Jackson with his one. Everybody's talking. I mean, I've said it too. Like, Jackson is probably the hardest one punch knockout artist a lot of people have ever seen. And not besides heavyweight, Wilder might be up there too. But, like, you know, when you see a Julian Jackson fight and you see the way, you know, the highlight videos of him and the way things would go down and all that, like, it was, dude was magic. You know what I mean? He just had to graze you and you just lost all ability of your body. But the thing that, you know, the catch with him too, is that if somehow you were able to reach his chin, you had a chance at him, because he didn't have the greatest chin in the world. You know what I mean? And that's what made it really interesting, is that like, if somehow you're able to hit him or really catch him, he could be wobbled. He could be hurt. Sometimes he could be starched. By the time he got up with Gerald McClellan, who had to take some ridiculous bombs himself, both low and on the chin, Jackson got caught himself. That's the thing. I would compare that one to the firefight. I would compare that firefight to maybe Golovkin and Jackson, what would happen. I think that Golovkin with his chin, and, you know, it's different to take a bomb from Canelo Alvarez, like no discredit to him, because obviously he hits hard, but there's a clear difference between taking one of Alvarez's right hands and taking a Julian Jackson right hand. So it would be interesting to see if Golovkin, that famous clip of Golovkin's head whipping like that after Alvarez catches him, and then everyone's like, oh, that's an all-time great chin. What if Julian Jackson took that right hand that he hit like Harold Graham with square in the face of Golovkin? Is he able to take the same shit like that and just stand there and just have his head whip that?
Yeah. So, yeah, well, and that's the question.
That's the question.
And the thing, at least in my opinion, when you're trying to compare like the punching power between like a Canelo and a Julian Jackson, is that, and again, it's not to slight Canelo or anything, but it's like
he has
figured out how to work the technique and maximize his power with the technique. So like, it's like, you know, he's countering and like, you know, like really putting it into it, whereas Julian Jackson was just whipping shots.
He was trying to take your head off completely.
And it wasn't, and it looked far more effortless, in my opinion. Like,
it was like, you know, him and his lady had dinner reservations and you were cramping his plans at the moment.
Yeah, and it could be with either hand, and it could come at any time, and he'd throw also in combination, and they were all hard. It wasn't just like, you know, one massive counter that he's worked on for fucking 3 months in the gym just to land that one uppercut counter, you know, type of shit like he did against Plant. Which was great. You know, don't get me wrong. It's just that against Julian Jackson, it's just a different story altogether. So yeah, is Golovkin's chin going to hold up like that against Julian Jackson? But also, I guess another fair question is, Gennady Golovkin, you know, in his quote unquote prime, whatever that is, he also had a pretty decent defense. he wasn't getting hit as much as you might expect somebody that offensive to get hit.
And I'm not going to say, I don't think he would try to go in there the way he did against someone like Vanes, for instance, or like one of his go-around opponents where he didn't care about getting punched because he knew they weren't a threat to him. I would say he would approach this more like he did David Lemieux. You know what I mean? Like just standing up and boxing and using his jab and probing and making sure he's taking the proper precautions and not trying to get like caught with anything stupid.
Yeah, I don't know that Julian Jackson winds up doing the moonwalk.
Yeah.
That night. I think Gennady Golovkin might be able to just weather that storm. I think that that's probably what I would go with.
I agree. I think that Jackson is going to catch him a couple of times. Golovkin is going to box more like, well, like I said, would box more like he did against Lemieux as opposed to how he would against someone like I said, Vanes or like Dominic Wade or someone of that nature. But eventually Jackson's going to come in, and the technique I think of Golovkin was better than Jackson's. And the chin of Golovkin's obviously is better than Jackson. So if Golovkin catches him and he's a monster hit him himself, he's going to catch him and probably starch him at one point. Kind of like Joe McClellan ended up doing. McClellan, like I said, just a little bit earlier, took some massive shots. But when he finally broke through and caught Jackson with that beautiful combination, boom, boom, you see Jackson go skidding across the ring like he got hit by a truck. And then he looks up and he's, you know, cut and just cooked. That was right there. I think the similar scenario right there. I'm definitely not going the distance, obviously. So I don't even think we'll go into the late rounds. I think by round five or round six, that's when it ends.
I think that's pretty fair, yeah. One way or another, I don't think it goes to the cards.
No. But I think it's going to be like early, not early, I think like mid rounds. So like five, six rounds at the latest.
Yeah, it's a good fight though. Good great power puncher versus power puncher matchup. All right, so back to Twitter. We got Kim Hakonsen on Twitter gave a pretty good idea for a matchup, in my opinion, underneath the, underneath one stable, but a matchup we never got but could have gotten, I suppose, Joe Frazier versus Ken Norton.
Okay. Yeah, you know, two guys both under the Eddie Futch stable. They did spar countless rounds together. Both very familiar with their very close friends, and that's why they vowed that they were never going to fight each other as well. But yeah, it's a fight that could have happened, especially it's one that's a glaring omission considering all the round robins that took place in the 70s.
Yeah, dude. And I mean, like, that's, you know, we've talked about this before, like the kind of the four kings or whatever, and the idea that Wilfred Benitez is kind of like the odd man out in that matchup, and that he should, some, you know, many of us believe that he should be included in that group. But then,
Hagler.
Yeah. And because that's really the only reason, I guess, is because the loop wasn't complete or whatever, but even so,
you know, to add to that point, Pat, really quick, it's interesting because you remember the documentary from 1989, Greatest Champions.
Yeah.
With all the heavyweights, Larry Holmes was in that. Larry Holmes never fought Joe Frazier.
Exactly.
Larry, you know what I mean?
Larry Holmes. Well, and that's what I was going to say, was that like so you like, have.
He was including in that thing. You could have included Benitez in that group too. So,
yeah. Yes. And so you have Ken Norton and then Larry Holmes, you know, included into the group of Frazier, Foreman, and Ali kind of. And I mean, whatever. I mean, I don't really care how you group them together if you don't group them together at all.
Yeah.
But still.
But Benitez, yes.
Ken Norton kind of does get a little bit of the short end of the stick, particularly for the controversial fights against Muhammad Ali, you know, the losses that many people believe should not have been losses. So either way, you know, we just never wound up getting this fight. And style-wise, I think it's pretty interesting, but it's really difficult to discount the fact that almost any time Ken Norton fought a serious puncher, that it didn't end well for him.
And it wouldn't end well for this one either. I love Ken Norton. Yeah, you know, the guy had a very good style and an awkward style against a wide variety of heavyweights of the 70s that he was very successful against, but he always had trouble against punchers. And whether it was a giant beast of a guy like Foreman who knocked him around, or a person who was built like a redwood tree like Ernie Shavers who knocked him out in 79, even Jerry Cooney when he was completely washed in 81, like Norton just always struggled with those guys. Or Frazier, the rampaging, the way he was with his bobbing and his weaving, that absolutely a crazy left hook. There was no way Norton was going to keep him off. Norton didn't have the style to keep a pressure fight like Frazier off of him, you know? It would have been really, really difficult. Norton wasn't a great mover like that.
Yeah, he would have locked horns with him.
Exactly. He would have eventually had to, you know, and Frazier just would have overwhelmed him. So I say Frazier in like four.
Yeah.
And that's not a discredit to Norton, but Frazier just would have bulldozed him.
Yeah, the dude who got really mad at us about Roy Jones might get mad at us about not respecting Kenny Norton in this one, but I...
it is what it is, and I love Norton. He matches up well against a lot of heavyweights in history, but not against Frazier.
Yeah, he just didn't do well against punchers overall and didn't have an awful chin, but didn't have the greatest chin. He got hurt against Muhammad Ali, too, especially in that second fight. Muhammad Ali hurt him, and Ali wasn't a massive puncher. But, I mean, yeah... Didn't do well against punchers, and on top of that, his style, he was very squared up a lot of the time. And it would have been
it was a variation of the crab defense that George Foreman and Archie Moore would use, but it wasn't, like you said, it was more awkward in how he would like wave and do things like that. So,
and he had a really good jab, but it's just that I think that he would end up being in a bad position against Joe Frazier and eventually wind up catching that left hook a few too many times. So, yeah, I agree. I think that's pretty fair. That's a fair assessment, but nonetheless, a fairly intriguing matchup that we never got.
One that we missed out on.
Could have been interesting at one point in like 73 or 74 or something like that. But let's see. There was another one here that I thought was really good that I thought we should talk about. Where did it go? There it is. All right. So our boy 1980s boxing on Twitter.
Yes. I made him a Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I figured I won't use his real name just in case he doesn't want us to, but he's on Twitter and he's got a lot of good chronicle.
Very, very knowledgeable stuff, man. Enjoy his content.
Seems to always be listening to or watching the show, which we appreciate. And he came up with a good matchup that I liked a lot, and that's Manny Pacquiao versus Wilfredo Gomez at featherweight.
Ooh, featherweight. Okay. See, that makes it different because at junior featherweight, it would be an easy pick to pick Gomez because that was Gomez's dominant weight and Pacquiao was still, I would say, still fine-tuning to what he ended up becoming. But at featherweight, he was starting to already put the pieces together. You know what I mean? Yeah, he was still a little raw. He was still a little raw and a little wild, but you saw everything coming together. And at featherweight, by featherweight, Gomez was already starting to slow down. So, yeah, this is an intriguing fight.
It's almost, it's got a very kind of crossroads-y feel to it.
Totally. Where
one guy is going up and the other one's going down, but if they meet at just the right time, and it's a lot of punching power too. That's where, I mean, I'm always going to love that puncher versus puncher matchup, even though they often wind up being like kind of like an MMA, like when they say, all right, well, and then they have two guys who wrestle really well. What usually determines it is some other style, you know, who's the better puncher or who's the better jujitsu or whatever. And it's similar, like, I feel in boxing, sometimes you get the puncher versus puncher matchups and it's just whoever's the better boxer is the one who winds up winning. But either way, you know, it's fun. It's going to be explosive. Manny Pacquiao at that point was still pretty wild. Hadn't really been honed in by Freddie Roach yet.
But he was getting there.
He definitely was getting there, but he could get caught. He could always get caught. You know, a guy, like I mentioned earlier with Golovkin and have said numerous times, when you have somebody who throws a lot of punches, they're going to be open to get hit more. That's just the nature of how it is. But, Manny Pacquiao could get caught. Mm-hmm. He definitely could get hurt. And Gomez was a puncher, man. The problem was, of course, Manny Pacquiao, also a massive puncher at featherweight.
Massive. And at that point, like you said, it's a crossroads fight. Gomez was already starting to diminish a little bit. So he wins. He loses the first time he goes for the featherweight title, he loses to Salvador Sanchez. Moves back down to junior featherweight, makes a couple of defenses, most notably the epic war against Lupe Pintor. And then he decides to come back and move back up to featherweight after Sanchez's death to challenge Sanchez's successor, Juan Laporte. Which was like, you know, they called it the battle of the Civil War Battle of Puerto Rico. And Gomez beat him, you know, comprehensively in a 12-round decision. But it was clear even in that fight, even though he won, you know, wide, that something like he was already just not the same guy he was at one point. So if you put him on 1984 Gomez, by the time he wins that right before he fights Azuma Nelson and gets overwhelmed and stopped against the Pacquiao that was on the rise, I think Pacquiao kind of does the same thing.
Yeah, he obviously caught, you know, the part of his coming out party, Lilo La Guaba.
Yeah.
You know, and then totally just pulling the wool over fucking everybody's eyes with, well, no, that's not the right, just I guess surprising everybody, not wool, with Marco Antonio Barrera. And just, yeah, that version of Manny Pacquiao, I think, is gonna be really, really difficult for Gomez to beat. But
and Gomez is gonna want to stand and trade with him at some point too. He's gonna get really prideful, he's gonna get part, you know, and he's gonna want to sit there and try to go with it. And if he does that, he's gonna get overwhelmed, you know, by the time he wasn't gonna be able to handle the heat. And with his face too, like, Gomez had a tendency to really swell up around his cheekbones.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, it would be a long night for him.
But I do think that it could be a little bit more interesting at 122 pounds.
Oh, my God. At 122, Gomez is prime. I think he beats the shit out of Pacquiao at 122.
Our guy tried to keep it like I wasn't trying to do like hard rules with the with the 8 weight classes last time. Like, we were just trying to have fun or trying to come up with ways to not get too wild with the matchups, really.
Exactly.
But yeah, at 122 pounds, I think that I'm not entirely sure I'd bet against Pacquiao, but it could be a far more interesting fight and a far more difficult fight for him.
I think Gomez at 122, I would favor. At 126, I favor Pacquiao.
I wouldn't argue too much with you, dude, especially Manny Pacquiao having to make that weight.
Exactly.
He was draining a little
bit. And even then, like, you know, we just mentioned the differences between 122 and 126 Pacquiao are, like, very different. Like, we're already there. 122 Pacquiao was wild. And as strong as he was and everything, like, if a guy like Agapito Sanchez could hit him up and make him struggle, Gomez would have tore him up at some point. It would have been an exciting fight. Gomez definitely would have got hit, but Gomez at 122 before his outside vices and everything else took place in the Sanchez beating was incredible. And you put him like the one that beat Carlos Zarate against a guy like Pacquiao at 122. Nah.
Yeah, that's a tough one, man. Yeah. That's a far tougher one.
So
going forward, J_Sparks101 on Twitter. Matthew Saad Muhammad versus Bob Foster, light heavyweight.
Not going the distance either.
Wowza. Yeah. So, I mean, hi. I mean, just give it to me. I'm getting excited just thinking about it, really. Wow.
You're just saying, just stick it in my veins, right?
Yeah. Just put it right into my bong and I'll fucking snap it right now.
Absolutely, bro. Just give me that pack right now. Give me that Saad Muhammad Bob Foster pack I can just put up and just blast my brain. Shit.
I mean, because obviously you got one of the hardest punchers at light heavyweight.
Yeah.
Dude who was just absolutely cleaning clocks. Vicente Rondon caught the wrong end of it. Mike Quarry. I mean, you know, just
everybody. Foster contributed to a lot of brain damage for the 70s light heavyweights and subsequent decades afterwards. Absolutely.
And he was so angry, even despite knocking everybody out, was just so mad.
Very bitter, angry. You know, he became a sheriff later on, so that explains it. Just very angry at all the time. Yeah. Like, you know, even later on in life and his career, you know, I remember we joked about it with you, Corey, and Gray. I've told you that there's photos in magazines of Bob Foster literally tearing up photos of Virgil Hill because Virgil Hill had the nerve to break Bob Foster's light heavyweight's defense record. You know? And it's like, man, what did Virgil Hill ever do? Do you need to go around bashing him, you bitter asshole? Like, yeah, whatever.
Would Quicks let North Dakota have their, you know?
What else does North Dakota have anything to cheer for? You got to go over there and bash Virgil Hill, you bum? All right, yeah, I call him a bum.
Quicksilver was good, man. He gets
on. Very good fighter, but not to veer off too quickly, man. Yeah, that's your thing. Bob Foster was just a brute, man. From when he knocked Dick Tiger's poor head into nosebleed seats in Madison Square Garden to where he just, you know, terrorized the light heavyweight division up until around 1974-75. No one had ever really seen anything like that, especially a guy like, you know, as tall and lanky as he was and just blasting people with one punch or just brutalizing them over the distance, you know. Comparably, you would see something like that with like Sandy Sadler back in when he was featherweight champion. And then you would see that, you know, a decade later with Tommy Hearns, what he was doing with welterweights and beyond. So Foster was an anomaly back then. You know, he was tall, he was skinny, he was lanky, he wore raggedy trunks. He just looked like a guy from, you know, another era, but he could destroy you unless he moved to heavyweight where he was outpowered and he got brutalized. But if you're talking light heavyweight, it's hard to match up against him.
Yeah, he could have been somebody who I suppose could have moved to cruiserweight or something like that had he come along a couple decade or two later, but didn't get that opportunity. And unfortunately, the only guys at heavyweight that were there for him to get big money opportunities against were the wrong fighters. Got Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier, who just, you know, knocked his dick in the dirt, unfortunately. Poor guy.
And even before then, guys like Doug Jones and Ernie Terrell and stuff were just beating him around. So it kind of just told Foster.
Yeah.
But that's where the money was. You know, even in the 70s, there was no money in the light heavyweight division. So Foster was forced to move up to challenge himself against these guys.
Well, and he had a right to be pissed off. We've talked about it, too. You know, the sanctioning bodies fucked with him. And I mean, I don't know if it was necessarily because he's Bob Foster, but so much as because they're the fucking sanctioning bodies and they've always been fuck boys and fucking around like motherfuckers. That's sorry, guys, but you are. But in any case,
my friend.
Fucking jerks. But, you know, Bob Foster was just a monster. He could hit like an absolute fucking truck. So you put him in against somebody like Matthew Saad Muhammad, though, whose signature move is getting blasted and then coming back to do some blasting of his own, you know. And it was only just the absolute other toughest fighters at light heavyweight who could take it and who could overcome him. Absolutely. Guys who were great in their own right. So I mean, that's a goddamn tough matchup, not in terms of just, you know, power, but that's tough. I don't know. I mean, I kind of probably would side with Foster just because I feel like
so do I.
I don't know that Matthew Saad Muhammad is going to be like, you know, rallying back from Bob Foster combos. That's a tough proposition, man,
especially if Foster ends up landing one of those whipping left hooks that he landed against Tiger or Mike Corey. I don't care who you are, you can be the King Kong or some shit, and you're
way Dick out. Tiger just like bat, like he like violently goes to the canvas, you know, like,
dude, if there was no canvas there, Dick Tiger would have gotten knocked into the New York subway system that day, right? I think under MSG is the A C and E train. He would have been on his way down to the Bronx. So I mean, you know, there's
like two fan angles of that knockout too from the stands. Yeah. And it's just like,
well, yeah, because Foster throws the shot and then he just on reflex comes back. You know, and it's like one of those, you know, when you had an action figure as a kid. Oh, no, here's the best example. When you would take a G.I. Joe toy, right? And you would like twist it up because remember they had the rubber insides of them. And if they didn't break, you twisted, then they'd spin move. That was kind of like what Foster did. Come here.
Yeah, dude. And then Dick Tiger winds up looking like a Pez dispenser, just
with his
head just absolutely pop, you know.
Or Mike Quarry, where Foster legitimately thought he died. And then you see Foster sitting in the corner, you know, just pondering what he did with the power that he has.
It wasn't even until we did that Quarry family episode that I saw that photo from overhead of Mike Quarry, like with the Robert Hellenius, like, you know, absolutely, stare. And then Bob Foster's going like this, looking over him, like, is he dead? Jesus. So,
and
I
then, mean, Foster's trainer coldly walking over to him and just saying, hey, man, business is business. As if to say, like, if he's dead, whatever.
Hey, well, at least Bob Foster wasn't digging his grave.
Yeah, seriously.
Oh, poor. Yeah, you know, he was only fucking putting guys in nursing homes, but he didn't dig any graves, so we're okay. No, that's a brutal
like
matchup.
That's a really good matchup. I like Foster in that one.
That's a brutal matchup, and I'd go with Foster too. But I mean, you know, I guess you just have to put the caveat on there that Saad Muhammad catches him just right. It could be lights out for Foster too. So. But that's fun. Totally fun. All right. Let's see. Another one. Let's go back to Facebook. Take care of those guys. Trav Weatherly, on Facebook had two good matchups concerning Jack Dempsey, both of which have been pondered, but are fun to talk about, in my opinion. Harry Greb and Jack Dempsey. Mm-hmm. And Jack Dempsey versus Harry Wills. I mean, they've been talked about before, but they're worth talking about. You know, Jack Dempsey reportedly sparred with Harry Greb. I think it was 2 days in a row, somewhat publicized. And supposedly Harry Greb was giving him the business, which is not super surprising because Jack Dempsey got his ass kicked in sparring all the time and by like absolute scrubs too sometimes. And also on top of that, the controversy surrounding Jack Dempsey never having fought Harry Wills, who was the top contender for his heavyweight title for like 3 years straight. You know, they're worth mentioning.
Yeah, absolutely. And their fights, again, that's been pondered and talked about throughout the decades. Absolutely. You know, fantasy fights. Greb, despite all the shit that he gets on Twitter, that people just saying, look at this guy, you know, I could ice him. Like, everybody always tries to like bash Harry Greb for whatever reason, because people get mad that he's considered one of the greatest fighters in history, if not the greatest, yet there's no actual footage of his fights. And the only footage that
people get pretty surly about it. It's pretty funny.
They get really angry about it. And they get pissed off because the only footage that is out there is him play sparring with Philadelphia Jack O'Brien. You know? So
it's crazy though, dude. And I'm sorry to steal it from you, it has to be mentioned because it happens all of the time when I post photos of like really old fighters and they have some funky stance and they're like, they fought like that back then. Oh my God. And I'm like, dude, did you not realize that they had posing and comedy and satire back then too? Are you dumb? Like, you know, they weren't going like that when they were fighting, you know, there's video of them. They're just posing like that because it's a pose, you know? But anyway, the same type of shit with the Greb footage, like, you know, like he's not fighting. It's anyway.
It's whatever, but that all that being said, man, Greb, by all accounts, and I really wish there was footage out there. There was rumors that there was for years. There's rumblings. Hey, there is a fight that surfaced, or there's this that happened, or that happened, or some shit, or whatever it is. And everybody gets excited. We're about to be in the year 2023. I think it should be like kind of calmed down.
Going up on 100 years from his death.
Yeah, we're at the point now, if something was going to surface, you think it would have surfaced by now. And if anything had even survived at that point, it might have just...
And if anybody's gotten and is holding on to it, you guys suck.
Yes, yes, totally, 1,000%, fuck you. But moving on, by all accounts, from everything we've read, because there's tons of documents out there, man. Unfortunately, if we don't have the footage, he was as one of the most popular fighters of his era. And of all the fights that he competed in against the highest level of boxing back then, there were tons and tons and tons of writings on him. So we get the perfect sense of what kind of fighter he was, how he acted, everything else about him. And with all that being said, man, and how, you know, tough and fearless he was, I think he whoops Dempsey.
Dude, I think that he's just the kind of fighter that, you know, Dempsey... He basically did everything Dempsey did except better. You know, Dempsey was the kind of guy, there's a really big mistaken view of what Dempsey was as a fighter. He was ferocious. He was unstoppable. You couldn't stop him. Yes. And then you watch some of his biggest fights and you're like, God damn, he looked like shit.
And he wasn't active either. He had one of the weakest reigns in heavyweight history. Like the thing is, like, Dempsey was one of the biggest sporting heroes of the 20s, and the 20s is always like the
19s. His reputation preceded him, you know. It's
In the 1920s, he was the darling of the sports world, as long, even bigger than I would suppose, like Babe Ruth or someone around there. Like Dempsey,
they were damn close. They were definitely damn close.
And you know, people from that era that, you know, they're active in the 20s and didn't, you know, fall apart from the Wall Street drop and then the subsequent depression, and were still, you know, around in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, dude, they absolutely would speak in hushed tones about Dempsey. And if anyone even dared to say anything about Dempsey to you, be like, oh, you know, well, Rocky Marciano might beat him, Joe Louis would have beat Jack Dempsey, or, you know, even if they were around in the 60s and 70s, Ali and subsequent.
Yeah, they were still going on. Yeah,
they were wild on you, absolutely wild on you. They didn't play that shit. Like, dudes, you know, Dempsey just had everybody in a tizzy back then, man. His style, the ferocity, his overall look, he had this aura about him. You know, he was married to the Hollywood the famous Hollywood actress back then. What's her name?
Estelle
Taylor.
Yeah, Estelle Taylor.
Estelle Taylor, like. Dempsey was just a superstar, you know, and he carried himself like one. And his fights were just like magic too. He didn't fight often, but when he did, you know, usually they were really exciting. Like when he knocked out a guy like Georges Charpentier, who was way too small for him and the light heavyweight champion, but like it was such a big event that, you know, caused the first $1 million gate. or when he fought Luis Firpo, who we've talked about before, who was so ungainly and wild that wouldn't have been a factor in any other era in heavyweight history. But back then, if you witnessed that fight live, people would talk decades about, you know, seeing Dempsey go flying out the ring, or, you know, fights of that major. But then think about it too, man. If you saw him against Tommy Gibbons, he goes 15 rounds and he looked like shit in that fight. And then aside from the seventh round in the rematch with Gene Tunney, Dempsey got whooped in every single round of that entire fight. He barely
knocked down in the next round.
Knocked down, exactly. Yeah. So
everybody forgets to mention that part.
Absolutely. And Ray Arcel mentions too in the book, In the Corner, that Dave Anderson wrote in the early 90s. He mentions that he witnessed Dempsey in his first fight in New York City when he first came in, before he fought Jess Willard. And he fought a guy by the name of John Lester Johnson, a black fighter who's completely forgotten today from way back then. And he said that John Lester Johnson slapped him around for 10 rounds easy, didn't even break a sweat in that. But since it was a no decision, Dempsey kind of like acted like he didn't care. But it shows there's a precedent there. You know what I mean? After that, Arcel also says that witnessing Dempsey beat Jess Willard, he thinks that Dempsey would have beat anyone in history. But yeah, man, there's a limit to Dempsey. There really is. That's all I'm going to say. There's just
he was built up.
But if you look at it through, like, you know, just not rose-colored glasses, you can see that there's a lot of heavyweights that probably would have whooped him. I don't consider Dempsey a top 10 heavyweight in history.
Sorry, no. I don't think he is. And I get it, dude. Like, you know, but yeah, a lot of the image of Dempsey is based off the Willard fight and nothing else.
Yes.
It's true.
Is still shrouded in controversy 100 years after the fact, too. Because, like, how does someone, I mean, Dempsey was a ferocious fighter, but how does someone acquire all of those injuries in only a few rounds like that? Like, Willard suffered some ridiculous injuries in only four rounds that
which are somewhat exaggerated too, though. But he did get fucked up.
Yeah, like, I mean, my man's face was just, I don't know.
Yeah, no, he did get fucked up, but they get, it's almost like a game of telephone where they get worse every time you hear it. Like,
broken jaw,
absolutely. A broken orbital, he's missing four teeth, he is missing his face, he's missing his dick, like, you know, and it fucking just escalates from there.
And then doctors until the end of his life spinning yarns about how, you know, saying, oh, well, guys, maybe I did put plaster of Paris in his gloves. Oh, actually, you know, if you watch the footage over here, you see the iron rod and put it in Dempsey's, like, such, yeah, because Burns was a piece of shit. He was a carny asshole. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, so I'm not trying to just, like, shit on Jack Dempsey. It's just that I think that, like, yeah, I just feel like it's a lot of the image is probably a little bit overblown. So I'd probably go with Greb to even outwork him, dude, in that fight.
Greb wanted the fight. Definitely did, man. You know, if, like, Dempsey...
And that's supposedly how their sparring went, too, was that Greb was just giving him the business and outworking him, just giving him work.
Totally. I'm sure Greb would have absolutely jumped to the opportunity to fight Dempsey. And that fight would have been huge. Huge at the time, because, like we said, Dempsey was the darling of the 20s, but guys like Parry Greb and Mickey Walker were massively popular at that and during that era as well. So
yeah, and Walker, you know, I would have loved to see something like that, but Walker is, I think, just a little bit too small. Like, even Greb had,
and Walker too, I think, came, well, yeah, I don't know if he would have been able to go with that. And Walker still was, by the time it was after the Dempsey era was over, Walker made his move to heavyweight. So
Yeah. By the, their paths just would never have crossed. But yeah, that it might have been fun. But then I think that you put Dempsey against Harry Wills, dude. I don't know. I mean, I think Harry Wills had the kind of style where he might not have been fleet of foot enough to get away from Dempsey, and it could have gotten ugly had he not been able to, like, put Dempsey away or something like that. But you know, a couple of years, like maybe like a year or so after Dempsey had won the title, once you start getting into the 1920s, Wills dipped pretty fast. But
by the end of the 20s, when Wills never got a title shot, there's, you know, he lost to Sharkey, who was on the rise by DQ, but by all accounts,
I think
Wills could be knocked him out viciously.
Yeah,
that fight was filmed. The Sharkey fight, I've never seen footage of. I'm not even sure if it was filmed. But by all accounts, Sharkey was whooping his ass when Wills got DQ'd in it. So, yeah.
So, I think it's an interesting fight.
That one would have been. And, you know, and the thing is, in history, Pat, like, I don't mean to cut you really quick, but, like,
yeah.
A lot of people feel that, like, I've noticed there's always been a theme that Wills was ducked, which he was. to a degree. I mean, like, they did try to make the fight. There's even tickets that were printed for it, and things were supposed to happen. So I don't want to say it was out and out.
It was planned, I think, twice, and it just fell through.
Yeah, it just kind of fell through for whatever reason. So you can't say he was completely ducked. It was planned for it to happen. But that being said, there's always been like a consensus, at least with some historians, that Wills just would have thumped Dempsey easy. Like you made the certain points. I'm not sure if it would have been that easy too, because of Will's style. It wasn't like the style of Dempsey, you know, was still a beast at that point. And it would have been tougher than most people expected. Like Wills could have got caught. He could have got clipped. And depending on when the fight took place and Wills is downfall and whatever. Yeah. So
I think
Greg beats him. I think Dempsey might actually beat Wills. I don't know, but Wills could beat him as well. That's cool.
I know. And that sounds super illogical too. And I don't want people to listen to that and be like, what, dude, you think Greg would beat him, but not Wills? And I'm just I think a lot of it's style, dude, points, and timing. Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's just
depending style on when the Wills fight happens. If you're talking with him in his prime, he probably could beat Dempsey, but Dempsey could caught him, you know, easily. But I think Greb's style is just tailor made to give Dempsey fits. So
yeah, like stay inside of his power, you know, kind of frustrate him
and everything. You'd outspeed him, out everything, and just. Yep.
I tend to think that that's probably how it would go. And on top of that, Greb was tough as fucking nails. He was not the kind of guy that, you know, he was, people want to talk about with the brine on his face, whatever. I get it. But it's like Greb was a literal tough motherfucker. He fought for at least 5 years, totally blind. Or no, sorry, not totally blind. Totally blind in one eye. Excuse me. Totally blind. Yeah. He didn't have any eyes. No, but nah, dude, I apologize because we're going to have to cut it a little bit short, but like I said, we were going to try to jam as much as we could in there. And on top of that, we have a ton, dude. I still have like a full page of mythical matchups that we need to get to on a subsequent show, which we will. But in the meanwhile, dude, I appreciate you. You know, we were just throwing shit out, man. And I appreciate that because it's a lot of fun. And I appreciate everybody who wrote in and gave us mythical matchups too. Very cool.
Definitely. Yeah, this was a lot of fun. I love talking about these things and like delving in and talking about the various scenarios you can go with it. So good stuff.
For sure, man. Hey, if anybody listened in on the podcast apps, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Subscribe if you haven't already. Leave us a reply or a rating. And if you watch on YouTube, thank you as well. Subscribe. Leave us a comment. I'm trying to answer as many as I can. And also, the Knuckles and Gloves podcast is on social media like Facebook and Instagram. It's also on Twitter, so give us a follow there. But we're also individually on Twitter. My boy Aris Pina is on Twitter as Punch Zone Aris. Me, Patrick Connor. I'm there as Patrick M. Connor. So give us a shout. We'll say hi. Aris, we'll talk soon, bro.
Absolutely. See y'all later.
Later, everybody.